Well, as we continue on through church history, we're pretty much for a number of weeks, for different reasons, through the missionary movement and so on, we've been in the mid-19th century, and that's where we're going to remain around the time of the mid-19th century. And I'm going to tell a story today of something that happened very significant in the church's experience here in the United States. And it's an awesome story. Fantastic events took place in the city of New York in the mid-19th century, 1857 through 1859, with repercussions, of course, for even a generation or two after that. And it's the story of the 1857 to 59 New York revival. Manhattan, of course, was becoming not just a very heavily populated part of the country, but it was a very fashionable place. Kind of for the first time in American history, there was a really trendy, fashionable little hub of the rich and famous. Now remember, this is before Hollywood, long before Hollywood. So there's no movie industry for people to become rich and famous through. Instead, the rich and famous are going to be the financial wheelers and dealers. The fat cats are going to be the guys that know how to buy and sell at the right time. And basically, the financial district of New York, round about what we now, of course, just simply know as Wall Street, but that whole area was beginning to grow in the mid-19th century. These were years of powerful, independent, wealthy individuals for the first time ever starting to come to the fore in the Western world to some degree. And in the midst of all of that, God was going to do a great work. He was going to do a great work in, certainly in Manhattan and in different places throughout this time, the mid-19th century. In different parts, there would be revivals, different places in the United States, and of course across the Atlantic as well, in England and Scotland and Ireland. But these were different revivals in the sense that they weren't dominated by remarkable personalities. Remember, we told the stories of the revivals that took place under men like Jonathan Edwards, and George Whitefield, and John Wesley. Very much the first and the second Great Awakenings were personality driven. You had these men that God raised up that were just mighty preachers, and it seemed wherever they went, there was just a move of the Spirit of God. Very unusual, to a very unusual degree. But the revivals of the 1850s that took place both sides of the Atlantic, and perhaps especially even in New York, they were not led by notable, charismatic personalities who really stand out in church history. Indeed, the English-speaking world was all impacted around this time, but really no Whitefield-like figure appeared to epitomize what God was doing. In the autumn of 1857, Wall Street was in trouble. It had known a period of just amazing boom, such as we saw over the last number of years until recently. There was an amazing rise in Wall Street wealth. But then in 1857, in the fall of 1857, there was a sort of Black Monday experience. Indeed, previously, Wall Street had known nothing but growth. Finances were going so well. But suddenly there was a decline, there was a fear, and there was a dread that was looming large over the financial district. Many who had pinned their hopes for the future of the country, for their own personal futures, on the stock market were stunned to discover that the free market was not the invincible God that they had come to think that it was. They had known only success, only growth up until this particular point. And suddenly their god, Dagon, if you like, falls on his face in the temple. And there's shock throughout the financial institutions. Businesses, companies, institutions that had previously appeared unshakable, free from any past market fluctuation, past market trends, suddenly, instantly just crumbled, and many disappeared. Many were wiped off the face of the earth in the fall of 1857. And it's strange because just from the amount of time I could spend on reading about this past week, it seems there were no plain, obvious economic reasons for it. There wasn't a war in Iraq. You know, there wasn't a global destabilization or nothing like that. It was a sudden, strange, unusual event that shocked the people who were involved. Analysts scratched their heads. Analysts reflected after the event, but no consensus has really been agreed on as to why this took place. There's various theories, there's much hypothesis, but there's no widely accepted rationale for this crash. It suddenly came and the financial district was shattered. However, generally, around this time, the average Christian actually believed it was an act of God's providence for the good of the nation, for the good of the country. It was intended to humble, they believed, the ever increasingly arrogant and proud and godless financial market. Incredibly, after a few months, there was even a sense in which many of the traders, and you'll understand why many would come to this conclusion, but after a few months, many of the traders who lost everything, many of the CEOs of the great companies that fell, they actually also began to agree with the Christian mindset that God did this, that there was no real obvious rationale as to why it should happen. The Lord had done it, and it was for the good of the nation, it was for the good of Wall Street, and many of these investors would say, and it was for my soul's good as well. Now, at first, that wasn't the way they were thinking. They were shattered. I can remember, actually, the Black Monday that came, was it about 1992 or 19, remember in about there? Remember seeing on TV the guys who were the investors and the guys on the floor of Wall Street sitting on the ground, leaning against the walls, trying to catch their breath as they just sat watching. Every time that ticker came round, they were losing billions. Just billions getting wiped off, and they're just sitting there going, watching it in disbelief as their God was fallen. Well, that was the same thing initially amongst the traders, but eventually the traders in the 19th century began to say this was good, this was God, this was humbling, this had to happen. It was the case that there was too much dependence, too much hope, too much love invested in the market. Priorities had gone awry, and God, it seems, was moving against the great materialistic tide that had swept New York City. It was noted by an observer that the race to be rich had, prior to the crash, reached a frenzied pace in New York City. For the first time, Americans were being caught up in what we call, justifiably perhaps, the rat race. New York was a rat race. Until then, there had been a lot of pioneering. This was a change that was taking place in America in just how business was done. Much investment of time and energy went into pioneering. There was a big focus in America until this point with regards pushing boundaries, settling areas, working hard on the land and so on. Few until now had been able to play around with investments and with capital. Most had been investing everything from their finances, their energy, their time, their emotion into the land, into building up the structure of the country. But now much of that is in place. And now there's a sense in which the segment of financiers and traders on the market is growing, partly due to the increasing number of businesses that are developing to supply the needs of an ever increasingly massive population. New York City, of course, had become the financial centre of America, which means that there was concentrated in South Manhattan especially, a whole new breed, a whole new class of Americans. They grew very rich, they grew very powerful through moving their money from one company, one business to another. They had power to make a business succeed. They could withdraw their finances and watch what had previously been a successful enterprise crumble before them. They, in many ways, this class of people that were growing in Manhattan, they had this sense that they were like God. Their wealth, their influence brought them tremendous power and influence with the politicians. Politicians were known to be crawling to their doors. They were a powerful breed. Now today we take the Wall Street institutions very much for granted. But in the mid-19th century, they were relatively new. Their power and their influence was still being explored. This new class of people were very much focused in the one neighborhood. And there were thousands of them concentrated in this area. And for the first time in modern Western history, there are so many rich, idle, arrogant people living together, playing together, wanting entertained together. So there's a whole new philosophy, paradigm opening up, if you like. Their affluence led to a terrible recklessness in how money was being spent. It was a time of decadence, a time of excess. It said that their conversations amongst this chattering class revolved around the latest imported furniture, the latest paintings that they had managed to acquire from Europe, their private designers who were filling their wardrobes with clothes that they would wear only once and then discard. And it was all just living in the, what we now would look at as a Hollywood bubble. They had this Manhattan bubble thing going at that time. They had leisure time. And that was even a new concept for many. They would negotiate a few deals, make millions, and then party, sometimes for years, on the back of those deals. And like never before, materialism is raising its head and is becoming, certainly in New York, the dominant spirit. But serious Christians in New York had begun to pray. They had prayed before the crash, during the crash and after the crash. They were alarmed not so much by the crash as they were about the spiritual death and the decadence and the materialism that it was bringing to the city. And the Christians saw the crash as an answer to their prayers. And then, as we said, many who had suffered great losses began to view this new financial hardship as something sent by God to get their attention. What happened to bring this about? What happened to cause these hard, arrogant sinners in their hundreds, in their thousands, in New York City to be humbled? So much so that by the end of 1859, about 1.5 years after the crash took place, many people thought not only of Manhattan as a place where stocks and shares were traded, but they thought of Manhattan as a place where prayer was offered up to God. People all across the world began to think of Manhattan as a centre for praying. What took place? The story of what happened is fascinating. It's thrilling. A man by the name of Jeremiah Lanthier was born in upstate New York as a young child. He came to New York City to find his fortune. When he came, he was not a believer. He was excited and wide-eyed at the thought of everything that he could have, that New York City had to offer him. But after a few years, Jeremiah Lanthier was converted. And from that point on, he showed himself to be a diligent, earnest Christian man. He attended a little church. It was a large building, but the numbers were small. It was the old Dutch church in downtown Manhattan on Fulton Street. The building was large. It was 88 years of age by the time he started attending it. Big facility, few people coming, congregation, somewhat disinterested even in the things of God. But he, as he went in amongst these people, took with him an enthusiasm for the gospel. He was not married, and as far as we know, he remained unmarried until the very day of his death, as far as we know. But that meant, in many ways, he was able to focus upon the things of God and give time and energy that a married man would not be able to do. He was an example of a committed Christian man. He was, as I say, a member of the old Dutch church. I think we have some slides here. There we go. Okay, this is South Manhattan. There's Wall Street. There's where the World Trade Center used to be. That's the site of the World Trade Center. And right below it, there's Fulton Street. And halfway along Fulton Street, there was the old North Dutch church that sat there. So it gives you an idea. It's right in the heart of this area. At this time in the mid-19th century, this is... Obviously, Wall Street is where the financial industry was really focused and still is. But all around here, it was all the financiers that were living. Many of them were still living in this area, round about here. And now they're all gone. There used to be mansions, but now they're all gone, and it's just big skyscrapers everywhere. There we go, the old... Oh, too much. We need to go back. There's the old Dutch North Church. It's an old building with an older congregation. But there was a real sense on the heart of the pastor that they would love to have a man, his name was Pastor Burns, who would be able to reach out to the arrogant rich who lived and who worked around the church every day. After about 8 years as a member of the old North Dutch church, Jeremiah Lanphier was asked if he would become the local missionary to the people of Lower Manhattan. He would be tasked with meeting people, just street evangelism, seeking to connect with people, especially at lunchtime when businessmen would be out on the streets, and seek to begin conversations and point people to Christ. He was seen as a man who had a good initiative, a man who was trustworthy, personable, and essentially, he was then allowed just to function in the role as he felt would be wisest. There was nothing really asked other than go out there every day and try to meet people and tell them about the Lord Jesus Christ. For the first few weeks, he stood on the streets with gospel leaflets. And it was said that he did well in doing that. He had apparently a very winsome personality. Allegedly, he was a very tall man and a handsome big man. People were attracted to his physique in the sense he looked very athletic. He looked as if he had something to offer, even from his appearance, so to speak. And then when they spoke to him, he had a warm smile, and he was generally good at street evangelism. As he spoke with people, he felt that there was something, in his words, something more needs to be done to enable one to connect and bring the gospel to these people. He just sensed that these businessmen were so rich and so full of themselves that it was almost impossible for him to connect at the level that he was seeking to. He met the rich around Fulton Street. And occasionally he went up slightly further north into the Lower East Side to where masses of European immigrants had gone. And there he would be confronted by the poverty and the sickness and the undernourishment and the neediness of those new European immigrants. And he found that he could witness and testify of Christ to them as well. He was just able to go to the rich and to go to the poor. He could, if you like, cross-culturally, he was a tremendous street evangelist. He was either found on his knees in the old Dutch church praying, or on the streets speaking to the people, helping them, aiming to present the gospel to them. On July the 1st, 1857, this lay missionary position began officially. However, also on July the 1st, he was thinking, well, what can I do? And he says this: the idea was suggested to my mind that an hour of prayer from noon to 1 p.m. would be beneficial to the Christian businessmen of Wall Street, who usually in great numbers take refreshment at that time. This came to his mind, but he didn't do anything about it. He thought to himself, you know, one of the things I could do at lunchtime is have a prayer meeting. And then he just said, nah, and continued on with his evangelism. He hit the streets and he was very busy, and there was an element of small success. Occasionally visitors would come to the church in order to be part of the Sunday worship through his invitations, but it was nothing spectacular. But in September, he felt this idea needed to be tried. The crash had come. Wall Street was humbled. Thousands had lost their wealth. Thousands of others were sufficiently humbled that they were shaken and looking for answers. Thousands of others were still in decent shape financially, but were no longer as self-dependent, as arrogant as they had been. It was a kind of 9/11 effect, if you know what I mean. There was a humbling went on generally. Some were devastated and others were just generally humbled. And Lamphere felt, perhaps it's time that we began this prayer meeting. On September the 23rd, 1857, the door of the third level lecture room, there's some various views of Fulton Street over the years. You can see where it is. It's in the busy downtown area. But the third level lecture room in September was opened up at lunchtime for prayer. There were, of course, at this point, a limited number of people who knew about this event. Naturally, Lanphier expected only a few people to show. He began himself at noon in that room that you see on the screen to pray. He set a few chairs out and he prayed himself, and nobody appeared. At 12:30, he heard the sound of footsteps coming up the stair, and one after another, three men eventually joined him before the Lord. At 1 o'clock sharp, the meeting ended. The three men quickly dispersed to get back to work. Lanphier felt that it was such a good and refreshing time that as the men were going down the stair, heading back to work, he called after them and told them that they would do the same thing this time next week. Let's meet next Wednesday noon and we'll pray once again. And it was agreed that if they had time during lunch, these men would come back. And the stress was on that if they had 5 minutes, that they could go back. There was no pressure. The little sign, as you see, was put up outside the church. And the idea was, look, if you're able, come on back and we'll pray for a brief time. The following week, September 30th, there was 20 men present. News of the lunchtime prayer meeting was starting to get out. It was said around the area that it had been a precious meeting. And hearts were gathered were melted with desires for the extension of God's kingdom. And there was a lot of pleading for the souls of the people of New York. In his private journal, Lanphier says, I was prepared for the prayer meeting at noon. And then I called for a number of persons to be present. I spoke to the men as I met them in the street. And as my custom is, if I can get their attention, I prayed that the Lord would incline many of them to come to this prayer meeting. I went to the prayer meeting and between 20 to 30 men were present. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. So, there's two prayer meetings now, a week apart at this point. First of all, three men come. The next time, 20 to 30 men. As 1 o'clock approached on this second prayer meeting day, Lanphier announced that if anyone was able to come back the next day, rather than waiting to next Wednesday, if anybody could come the next day, even for 5 minutes, he would be there praying and they would be welcome to join him. He felt it was such a good time of prayer that it would be responsive on his part to try to encourage others to come back and to keep praying. The next day, the numbers were up again and the sense of God's presence was also, if you like, up. From that day, for years, there was a lunchtime prayer meeting in Manhattan. On October the 8th, a large number were present. And the space in that little third-story lecture room was overly crowded. There was what was described as uncommon fervency, deep humility, and a great deal of self-abasement. It was like a sense that God was breaking hearts. No one, it seems, was using the prayer meeting in order to score business points. And some had been afraid that that's what would happen, that businessmen coming at lunchtime would try to use it for their own business connections or say things in prayer that would somehow help them in a business way. But it was obvious that that wasn't happening. On the contrary, there was much confession of sin by men who had previously done everything to make sure their reputation was intact and held together. Now they're there daily confessing their sin, humbly pleading with God, crying out for mercy. Men who in the past had power now are looking to the one who is all powerful. On the 13th of October, there is a rapid advancing, an intense growing. There's a sense that God's at work. The numbers are growing. Now, in the second month of the prayer meeting, accounts are that people began to come in order that they might be confronted with the gospel as these people are praying. So unconverted people are starting to hear about this prayer meeting, and they're coming to the prayer meeting to hear men pray for them. And then in the prayer meeting, they begin to stand to their feet and cry out to God for mercy and for salvation. People who did not previously even attend church are coming to these prayer meetings to see what's going on. They're curious. They're exposed to the gospel as it's prayed, as men are confessing their sins, and they join in and they confess their sins also. Often a man would find Christ, and it's said that he would the next day bring his friends and publicly pray for the people that he had brought to the prayer meeting. And often some of those individuals on their first occasion would themselves stand to their feet and ask the Lord Jesus to save them publicly. This is still in October. The prayer meeting started in September, and it was supposed to be once a week, but now it's every day. And the numbers are continuing to grow. In the middle of October, still October, Lanphier writes, I attended the noonday prayer meeting. Over 100 were present. Many of them not professors of Christianity, but under conviction of sin and seeking an interest in Jesus Christ. Inquiring what they should do to be saved. God grant that they find Christ to their precious souls. A wonderful thing was happening. Something that was unorganized, something that definitely was not orchestrated, was taking place. It was just intended that Jeremiah and a few men at lunchtime would pray. God was, however, moving and drawing his own to himself. Now the prayer meeting generally began to take a whole new form. It was felt that because God was moving so mightily in the prayer meeting, that time should be given for the needy to make requests, so that all might then see the answer to prayers. And literally there would be, there are so many accounts of a request being made on a Monday for perhaps a friend, a colleague, a family member to be converted. On a Tuesday, more than likely that person would be in attendance at the prayer meeting, and others would be praying for that person, and perhaps the next day or so that same person would announce that God had graciously saved them and answered the prayers of the prayer meeting. This was becoming commonplace. The prayer meeting moved from being full of general prayers for New York City, that's how it started, to being specific prayers for individuals in New York City who were connected to the people in the prayer meeting, and then they were seeing those prayers answered specifically. The prayer meeting had entered its second month, and it was felt that Lanphier should let the editors of the religious papers of the Eastern Seaboard know about this. People need to know what God is doing. And so he spoke with a couple of the editors of the newspapers and asked that they would advertise what was going on. He considered that God was pouring out his blessing. God was heaping his blessing upon the people. And it would be a sin for him to not make it known. Others should be able to come and themselves know God's blessing. So Lanphier asked the editors to give notice of the prayer meeting. They became fascinated by it, and not only did they include an advertisement in their newspapers, but they would send reporters. Sometimes the reporters would come and spend several days there, and they would witness what was going on. One day, there's a prayer request, prayers are made, the next day the person who was prayed for is in attendance, the next day that person gets up and proclaims that they've met Jesus Christ. And this was happening in the newspaper, the religious newspapers in America, which were several, and fairly influential at this period of history. They're telling these stories, and of course, that's stirring up more interest. Before the revival even began to be publicized, more than 2 months had passed. It wasn't advertised before it happened, and that's different from how so-called revivals operate today. Nowadays, it's decided we'll have a revival in September, and it's put in the newspaper, we're going to have a revival in September, it's all planned. And then they have their so-called revival. It's not a revival, it's just a bunch of meetings where everybody's to come out night after night, and people get stirred up and whipped up, and some, undoubtedly, we trust, are converted. That couldn't happen, because this was a real revival. And the first advert of it came 2 months after it had actually taken place, because it was God that organized it, planned it, and brought it about. It wasn't a bunch of men. Lanphier himself didn't know it was going to happen. It was a work of grace. The Fulton Street prayer meeting attracted a whole lot of attention. People in New Jersey began to come and visit on the odd occasion. From all over New York State, people wanted to attend. Pastors from the whole of the New York area, Brooklyn, the Bronx, Queens, and so on, began to come on at lunchtime to the prayer meetings to see, to observe what God was doing. They in turn would go back to their congregations and they would tell of what they had seen. And oftentimes the Lord would even revive their churches. And all over New York, all over New Jersey, prayer meetings were beginning to start up. Sometimes twos and threes, fours and fives. But people are praying. Interestingly enough, once this prayer meeting became known of in a wider sphere, it was also discovered that simultaneously, in fact, perhaps even before Lanphier started the Fulton Street prayer meeting, across the river in Brooklyn, in the Plymouth Church, there was another prayer meeting commenced under the same circumstances. They didn't know anything about each other, but in Brooklyn there was a similar thing happening at a smaller level and a smaller scale. But still, it would be significant that the Lord was working in different places at the same time without orchestration. One man deciding that on his way to work he would stop off an hour early at church and pray. If two or three could meet for 5, 10, 15 minutes, then what a better start to the day could be enjoyed. That's how the one in Plymouth, in Brooklyn began. Just one man said, well, I could stop off at church and pray. Could you join me? And that happened. A man joined them. Then 5 more, 10 more, 15 more. And so it grew in Brooklyn. And it only came to light after the Manhattan work began to be publicized through the media. It's said that the fear of imitation held back other churches in Manhattan from starting their prayer meetings. They were afraid. Some prayer churches in Manhattan felt, well, if we start a prayer meeting, it looks as if we're just trying to copy them, and they held back. They were afraid of being presumptuous. There was perhaps a genuine humility at work. In other words, let's not artificially jump on the bandwagon. But other Manhattan churches said, no, this is a good thing. God's at work. Sure, we didn't think of it first. Sure, it wasn't our idea. We realised that. Yet God is blessing. God's at work. Let us then humbly move and act and see if God will bless here also. And so, while some churches held back, others said, well, why not imitate a good thing? And why not copy them? It's not about pride. It's not about who thought of this first. It's about, is God doing something? And sure enough, the Lord blessed all over. As the second month was about to end, there are now morning, afternoon, and evening prayer meetings in churches all across Manhattan every single day. Shopkeepers are now shutting up shop, not for lunch, but for prayer. Businessmen on the way to work, during work at lunchtime, on the way home from work, are stopping off, sometimes for 10 minutes, sometimes for 15, and they're praying and then heading off home again. It's said that as the tide of the prayer rose, so correspondingly did the sense that the unconverted of New York feel that the church, that Christians really cared about their souls. These prayer meetings were not little insulated holy times for the church. These were, if you like, factories where there was a generation of burden, an increase of burden for the lost, and then the Christians are now in their daily lives beginning to manifest a care for the souls of the lost that previously the lost had never sensed before. It's interesting that the resorting to the place of prayer did not make the believers more detached, more aloof, more artificially pious. Instead, it made them more genuine, more caring, more interested in the lost like never before. And the unbelievers in New York became aware that Christians care for them. They felt loved by the Christians. Now, perhaps there was two things going on. Perhaps there was a tenderness developing in the hearts of the saved for the unsaved, that previously they had perhaps had the Good Samaritan approach, crossing to the other side, looking down on the lost. Perhaps that was going on. Perhaps also the unsaved were having a tenderness develop in their hearts, a softening, a less cynical view, a less critical spirit pervading them as they viewed the church. So that's what this revival was doing. It was in many ways bringing the lost and the lost and the Christian together. Not that it was causing the Christian to start to so-called act like the world, but it was enabling a connection to be made that previously the unsaved certainly hadn't felt before. The truth was commending itself, if you like, to every man's conscience in the sight of God, and men and women could not hide from it. Increasingly, men and women in New York did not want anymore to hide from the gospel. They were more open, they were more interested, they were more lively. When a Christian would seek to begin a conversation about Christ, there was more of an interest, more of a curiosity, more of an openness. And it all began because a man said, "Let's meet at lunchtime and pray." It was felt that prayer was not a forum, not a religious ritual, but it was a mighty, potent weapon in the hands of Christians. Those who had previously avoided prayer meetings, felt they were too busy, they suddenly had time and they had enthusiasm and they could not avoid the times of prayer. Christians were more reverent, more awestruck at the thought of prayer, more privileged at the thought of prayer, realizing the honor that this was not just a ritual, this was something God had designed to really change things. The unbeliever began to respect prayer, began to fear prayer. In November of 1857, now still just in the third month, a change is going on all over New York City and beginning to penetrate many other parts of the United States. We talked about the religious press and how in the second month they spread the news of the revival. But what would the secular press do? It's one thing when the religious press tells a story. Christians are basically hearing from those that are already converted. But what about the secular press? What would happen? Would they draw their cartoons as they were doing in London? They were in London drawing cartoons of Spurgeon at this time. And every week there was some new cartoon mocking Spurgeon and his ministry in London. Is that what the American media would start to do with this? Would they mock it? At the beginning of 1858, January of 1858, the secular press, the big papers, the New York Times, it wasn't the New York Times, it was the New York Herald, which I believe was the big paper at that time, they began to publish stories of answered prayers. They essentially took up the stories that the religious press were telling of how one man would ask for prayer for a person and then that person would a day or two later profess Christianity. And they would literally just copy the religious press. They would take up the same stories and tell them in a very similar way. On the whole, the stories of the prayer meetings were accounted in approving and positive ways. Even in the big secular press, there was columns such as the revival columns, daily columns written about what was going on in the revivals, read by hundreds of thousands of people. And God used even the secular press to spread the story of what he was doing amongst the lost. In January of 1858, Jeremiah Lanphier was called to a press conference with the editors of all the New York major papers. And afterwards, he was deeply encouraged that there was a soft heart towards this work. He'd been nervous about going into the meeting, but he left the meeting thinking that he had friends in the media. Some speculate that one of the reasons that the press was so amenable to the revival was that there was not one character or personality at the head. It was obviously something lively. There was a grass, from a secular perspective, there was a grassroots level work going on. There was no figurehead, no Whitfield, no Wesley for them to focus on and pick holes on. Lanphier wasn't a big personality. The story was known that he started the prayer meeting, but in many ways, when the prayer meetings were going on, he was just one of the men at the prayer meeting. It's not that he had become this big figurehead or this organizing personality. The other prayer meetings were all starting up with local pastors or men in different churches just starting up their prayer meetings. It wasn't like Lanphier had started up this big organization and he's now at the head of it. Nothing like that. Instead, Lanphier is very much just part of what's going on. So there's not a figure for the media to pick on and try to find faults with. At the end of the fourth month, the Fulton Street meeting occupied all three large rooms. Essentially, three separate prayer meetings are going on three different levels in the church every single day. And every single one is packed. Then they moved, and the picture on the screen is of a facility that they rented. It was a theatre nearby. They moved so that they could bring everybody together. And then they outgrew that, and then they quickly had to try to find other rented accommodation at lunchtime. And so throughout the lower Manhattan area, eventually there's lots of different prayer meetings in different facilities. Some back into the Fulton Street Church, the old Dutch North Church. Different levels, some in the theatre, some in other facilities, where people are renting out buildings. Businessmen are doing it themselves, paying for it, so that they can have a place to pray. Now in the fourth month, and interestingly, and this goes against all of the paradigms of revivals up until now, interestingly, still in the fourth month, and still no preaching. Isn't that interesting? All of this has taken place without preaching. Now don't get me wrong. These people who are being converted, they're going to church on the Lord's Day, and many of them are going where pastors are now fired up, and men who were getting weary in the ministry in Manhattan are now stirred up and they're desirous to minister and take the word. So it's not that there's no preaching, but it's still very much a praying revival. As opposed to First Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening, preaching revivals. This is still praying. The prayers are energetic and they're full of the gospel, but there's no formal preaching. In the fourth month, there's five regular prayer meetings in the Fulton Street Church alone. And it's still just continuing to boom. When ample provision of space was found, they found it filled up quickly. It's kind of like the freeways in Southern California. Build a new freeway, build another lane, and before you know it, it's full. And you think, what was the point of that? We're told that in the space of the first year, over 150 of these prayer meetings, whether it's morning, lunch, or early evening coming home from work, over 150 of these prayer meetings started up in Manhattan. just in Manhattan. All attracting crowds, all of the prayer meetings reporting remarkable answers to prayer, all of the churches in Manhattan finding that people are coming and joining the church and showing themselves to be credible Christians. Great and notable numbers of conversions. And then the same stories are told from Baltimore, from Boston, from Washington, D.C., from Charleston, from St. Louis, from Pittsburgh, from Cincinnati, from Chicago. In other words, all over in the major population areas where businessmen, you know, on a daily basis would be found in great numbers, this kind of thing was happening. The same enthusiasm for prayer was catching on. This revival lacked almost everything that Charles Finney had insisted as being necessary for revival. Charles Finney in the 19th century had used techniques, he had used tactics to keep things going. He developed revivalism and the methodology of revival. But this revival lacked everything that Finney said was needed for revival. There was no anxious seats where those who were allegedly anxious would sit and be focused on and stirred up. There was no unrestrained excitement. There was no artificial exuberance. There was no extreme zeal. Oftentimes these prayer meetings were characterized by a deep solemnity, a sense of the awesomeness of God. And men who are not necessarily articulate and flowery in their language, nevertheless, just simply pleading with God. There was nothing to attract the flesh. No special music, no rock bands, no bumper stickers, nothing that's cool. Just any building, any room that would do, and people were flooding in to pray. What a sense of sobriety began to really hit the Northeast. Common people being touched by God. Yes, there was enthusiasm. It wasn't dour, but it was a different kind of revival from the 1830s. There was a sobriety and a quietness about it, and that disarmed many of the cynics. That was, in a sense, part of its strength. Those who had become very cynical of revival because of the Finney attributes, they have nothing to say about this. It's shockingly normal people who are behaving in shockingly normal ways. What a wonderful thing. God used this revival to curb the excessive materialism, to stir churches up with a genuine desire for the souls of the lost. It was used to bring thousands into the kingdom. Thousands upon thousands. The old North Dutch church was an old Calvinistic church. Old Dutch Calvinistic church. Yes, it had been dying. It wasn't doing so well when Jeremiah Lanphier went and began his evangelism and then started the prayer meeting. There was a lot of people who could find fault with the zeal of the church, undoubtedly, but God was able to take that, and that church grew and entered into a whole new phase. God was pleased to show that while Finney, in his doctrine, had taught much of America, and many evangelicals had embraced it, that Calvinism was a death knell to evangelism, in many ways this revival showed that that just plain old isn't true. Where Calvinism is faithful to the gospel is present, and God is still able and mighty to save. And so multitudes were brought to Christ throughout the 1857, 1858, into 1859. There were, as you see, signs posted. There was a desire to, if you like, make sure that the long-winded were kept short-winded and so on. Prayers and exhortations not to exceed 5 minutes in order to give all an opportunity. Not more than two consecutive prayers or exhortations. And no controverted points discussed. In other words, this is not a place for you to flaunt yourself. Come pray. pray briefly, pray simply. Brethren are earnestly requested to adhere to the 5-minute rule. These signs went up all over in these prayer meetings. If you can't say all that you need to say in 5 minutes in public prayer, then you need a wee lesson on how to speak short and shut up. Spurgeon actually said that as well. Spurgeon said that he never prayed long in public. He also said that he never prayed more than 15 minutes. He never prayed for more than 15 minutes, but he says that I never go 15 minutes without prayer at the same time. Land Fear, obviously, he passed away in 1898, and his grave still stands. The 150th anniversary of the revival was marked in Manhattan, not by the city council, by private individuals. And several of these full-size bronze statues, Land Fear sitting on a bench, were put up in the South Manhattan area, around about Battery Park, the Wall Street area. Enough space for a couple of people to sit down, but then a little reminder of the man who went out and met people and who brought people into the prayer meeting. So they're actually, I believe, still there in South Manhattan, and they'll be there as long as the vandals allow, I'm sure. Any comments or questions on what we've said this morning? Matt? I was going to go back to Manhattan there. Let me do that. Let me go back to this map. You see, at the time, this area here, the financial district was very much centred here, and a lot of the people who were part of the financial district were living in and around this area. You know, round about City Hall, tiny little City Hall in Manhattan. Still there, they don't really use it for everything now, of course. But even back then, see this area here, the Lower East Side, today it's still a lot of big projects, a lot of, you know, housing projects still in that Lower East Side area. And the revival did spread, and there were churches all over in these areas as well. And within the first 6 months or whatever, the whole of Manhattan is involved in this. We tell the story of how it started. It started primarily with the businessmen, but it affected the churches in the whole area, and that has always been, you know, that's where a lot of the immigrants came and settled. You know, there'd be a lot of, early immigrants. In fact, Chinatowns there, Little Italy, you know, nowadays tourist traps, but even then, many Chinese immigrants starting to come in. A lot of poverty, a lot of congestion. Little Italy, now it's real cool, nice Italian restaurants. Back then, Italian immigrants piled up on top of each other, disease-ridden, you know, poverty. So this whole area was very mixed. You know, you had a lot of rich mansions round about here. You know, this whole southern area. Remember, of course, the World Trade Center site, that would have been mansions as well. And then up right neighbouring, it was poverty. And the whole revival included the rich, the poor. Bruce, it said that the primary kind of stirring motivation here in Manhattan was the Wall Street crash, you know, that humbled people. But behind the scenes, there was a whole lot of changes taking place. You know, civil war was beginning to kind of brew in the background, but it wasn't necessarily one of the main issues on the minds of the people at New York at this time. You know, it's certainly part of the social fabric of America, but primarily this crash humbled this area, and that's what started the sense of needing the Lord in Manhattan. Troy, then Tim. You know, the interesting thing about most of the revivals, like the First Great Awakening, it totally took America, you know, the North and the South by storm. Within a couple of generations, the effect of it was not as evident, because God has no grandchildren, if you know what I mean, you know. And then the Second Great Awakening, similar. There was like really a generation completely caught up with the gospel. And yes, there are some effects that trickle down, but with even the Second Great Awakening, in that time frame of that awakening, it went from being something that was really solid to something that Finney was beginning to manufacture. So by the time you get to the mid-19th century, yes, there are effects of the first and second still in culture, but it's amazing how quickly it disappears. And this particular awakening, the 1850s awakening, both sides of the Atlantic, and we'll talk a wee bit more about this next week, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Northern Ireland 1859 revival that happened at a similar time. They had, again, a powerful generational effect. It's like God moves and a whole generation is touched by the gospel. Often the next generation are beginning to give away the ground that was gained, and then the generation after that don't even know that ground existed. You know, it's as quick as that. But, you know, revivals, that's maybe good, because it means you can't keep looking to the blessings of the past. You know, the fact is we need to be praying about today. It's about now. You know, it's not about what the Lord did 10 years ago. It's what the Lord is doing now and our need for the Lord today. You know, and it's easy. Like, in Scotland just now, there was a great move of God in the 1950s in Glasgow. It was awesome. I don't remember it, obviously I wasn't born, but it was an awesome... You were too, but... He just got a big cheesy smile there, that's why I threw that up. But it was an awesome work of God in Glasgow. And, you know, Janice was home there just recently, as you know. And one of the Saturday nights, there was a get-together for everybody who was part of that. And she wanted to go. I'd say, go so we can hear who's there. And, you know, all the kind of, you know, I saw so-and-so and so-and-so. But what's happening is that older generation, these people are all now in like their 70s and 80s, and there was a couple of hundred of them that came together to basically reminisce. Now we're going, man, they're kind of living in the past, and they are, but for them it's helping them as older saints on their way to heaven to remember how good God was. But it's got no relevance to what's actually happening in Glasgow today. You know, the rest of the city looks on and goes, what are these people going on about? You know, it's got no relevance. But as older Christians, they're able to reflect and enjoy it and kind of chew the cud a little bit on their Christian experience. You know, that kind of thing. Excuse the gross illustration. But you get the idea. You know. Okay, our time has gone. So let's pray briefly and then get our kids and the restroom and so on. Father, we thank you for what you did in New York. We're excited to think that when things were at a spiritual low, a man starting to pray had no idea what would result. And Lord, we have no idea what can result from our worship today. We have no clue what you can do. Help us, Lord, to have faith and confidence in you, and to be humble and to look to you for grace and mercy. In Jesus' name, amen.